Well, I was born in 1893 and went to the country school until I was around 12. And then I was working on the farm. We worked a sharecropper, and that meant that we didn't make much money. My father had given me a deal of tobacco, a couple of acres, and when it was sold and I got my share in 1910, I had $10, $12. I had $12 for my year's work. And I told my father we were out in the cotton field picking cotton the day I left home. And I told my father that he had promised me a trip to Philadelphia. And I asked him when could I go after he was talking about the little money that I'd made. And he told me that I could go any time. So I finished, as I remember, finished that raw cotton, left that bag of cotton sitting at the end of the row. And so far as I know, it's still sitting there.
Brothers and sisters, greetings. This is the Reverend Marshall Lorenzo Shepherd, Jr., welcoming you to Going North, Tales of the Great Migration, a series of programs on the experiences of Southern blacks who came up from the South to Philadelphia during the early years of this century. Today's show is entitled, Going North. When the First World War broke out, the United States was receiving immigrants from Europe at the rate of well over a million a year. From this massive influx of Europeans, American industry had gathered a large proportion of its workforce. But immigration dropped off precipitously after the outbreak of hostilities, falling from 1,200,000 in 1914 to only 326,000 the next year, and down to 111,000 in 1918. At the same time, American industries were working at full capacity, producing armaments and war material for the belligerents abroad, and its labor needs were growing quickly. Philadelphia's industries were participating heavily in the war boom. The Midvale Steelworks in Nicetown, Baldwin Locomotive, Cramp Shipyard, Pencoyd Steelworks, and other heavy industries in the area all depended upon large numbers of unskilled workers. At the same time, the railroads were in growing need of upgrading and repair, and the once plentiful supply of cheap European labor was nowhere to be found. Prior to the war, northern industries had not employed blacks in any numbers, except as strike breakers. But with the outbreak of the hostilities, eyes turned south. At boardroom conferences held in New York, Philadelphia, Detroit, and all around the country, the character of the Negro worker was discussed and fretted over, his fitness for industrial work debated. And then, in the spring of 1916, a number of companies made the decision to try out the Southern Negro. Ernest Gray.
I come up on free transportation. Then, that particular time, they had it out that they wanted to get all our colored people from down there if they possibly could. So they sent a train from... They wouldn't let us leave at the Union Sheds. We had to get aboard the train from a place called Four Mile Hill. That's out from Savannah, from near Charleston, going all the way to Charleston. So we had to go out there to get the train coming now. Train about 13 coaches long. You know, everybody, all of us tried to go. They didn't want nobody. Come and had a seat. We all got to have a seat. But the whole gang of them didn't have any seat, but they hid when the man come through the checking, see. They would hide under the seat and like that, and that's the way we got away from there.
As the story goes, William Atterbury, vice president in charge of operations for the Pennsylvania Railroad, conceived the idea of sending to the Deep South for Negro workers. He commissioned Reverend James Duckery, a Baptist minister and messenger in his office, as his recruiter and labor agent. In the spring of 1916, Duffy went down to Jacksonville, Florida, the terminus of the Atlantic coastline, and quickly returned with several train loads of Negro laborers. Within weeks after the first train load left Jacksonville, the exodus had begun in earnest. Railroads weren't the only organization sending south for workers. The Armstrong Association of Philadelphia, founded in 1907 by Quakers, primarily as an employment bureau for Negroes with skills, was throughout the period one of the most active organizations in finding jobs and providing services for the incoming Southerners. After the outbreak of the war, the need for workers became critical. The Armstrong Association sent their industrial secretary, A.L. Manley, on a swing down south. His son, Milo Manley, remembers.
They needed labor. So it was decided that my father would take a swing around to the south because he had contacts, of course, from his days as the editor and owner of a newspaper in the south. And so he made a tour, and then on top of that, my father looked like a white man. Nobody would expect anything, except anywhere he went. He would go and explain to the community leaders, like the, well, usually it's a local minister or undertaker who was quite a top person in among the Negro groups in the communities down there, explain to them what could be, and they in turn would reach out and talk to people, knew somebody didn't have any work, and chase them up. And little by little, the word spread, and when one comes up and gets a job, zip, word goes back down south, and here comes more of the family. Well, it was a word-of-mouth thing that spread around like that. There were jobs that could be obtained up here, which were far better than what was going on down there. And that's how the thing got started. And a little bit, not only here, but Detroit and Chicago and other places of that sort. The idea would come up here to get a job.
As the migration grew, Southern authorities became alarmed by the flight. Due to the previous lack of Northern interest in Negro labor, they had never before had to worry about a massive flight of their niggers. But as wharves emptied of their longshoremen and the cotton fields and mines were left abandoned, their dependence upon what had been a mistreated and malcontented labor force became all too apparent. Jacksonville lost one-third of its colored population. Some counties in Alabama, the state hardest hit, lost over one-third of their working populations also. Ports in Georgia and lumbering operations in Mississippi shut down as men and women fled north. The mayor of New Orleans telegraphed the president of the Illinois Central Railroad requesting that he not sell any more tickets to blacks. The mayor of Atlanta traveled to the city's black Methodist churches trying to convince the people that they were constitutionally unfit for the rough northern climate and that the cold weather would cause them to come down with pneumonia and tuberculosis. Would you believe that the Jacksonville City Council passed a bill requiring labor agents to pay $1,000 to sign labor for the northern fields and shops and began arresting labor agents who, upon posting bail, would be right back on the street signing up more men. In desperation, the police were ordered to prevent the boarding of trains. Many persons were arrested or sent away, their tickets confiscated. Mr. Brown.
Two of them would always be together. Say, look, don't he look like the guy that raped that white woman the other day? The guy looked, yeah, he does look like him. Say, did you rape? No, I didn't do anything like this. Well, come on, let's go on down there. Let's go on down to the station. Let's see what we can find out about you. Take you right on the way. If you got a ticket going somewhere, by the time they let you go, that ticket wouldn't be any good. You had to get money together all around, all, you know, all. So that's the way they did us down there.
I remember when we decided to leave lock, stock, and barrel. Wasn't taking nothing, just moving out. We went to the railroad station on West Broad Street in Savannah.
Edgar Campbell.
Some of the authorities was resentful because so many of the blacks were leaving, and they objected to it. And I never forget, as a little boy, they decided they were going to pick all these people that was at the station and say they were lounging around. They had a hearing in a court, as I remember, and the judge was named Judge Schwartz. And the judge said, well, what do you bring these people here for? He said, well, they were all piled up at the station waiting to go north. I remember as if it was yesterday. Judge Schwartz said, they can't come to my house and catch a train. They can't come to your house. Isn't that what the station's there for? Yes. Discharge. Everybody went back to the station. Most people got on that train. Came north.
Savannah, Georgia, August 18th, 1916. The agent made an address to the members of the race on Monday, August 7th, the day the crowds left the city for the 4 Mile Hill on the Louisville Road. Farmhands and workers from rural districts are coming in from all parts of the country because they have been promised $1.80 a day with chance for advancement. They have their suitcases. Some are only in jumpers and overalls, but declare that if once in the state of Pennsylvania, they will never set foot in Georgia again. They are determined not to live where taxation without representation is in vogue.
My father, they know he was a carpenter, and they needed a whole lot of those kind of men up north here. You know where he had to get away? They went to church, and this man, this recruiter, and give them a long list of things that they had to do. There were carpenters, there were plumbers, and there were painters. So he got all those men together. He said, now I'm going to take all you together at one time. What they had to do at a certain time in the dark of night, they had to go to the outskirts of the city on a railroad spur, and they had put an old raggedy car on that railroad spur. He said at a certain time, he was going to be on that car. He knew when everything was ready. He was going to light a cigarette on the deck of that old car. And the men that was hidden, my father was one, they were hidden in the bushes alongside of that thing, laying in the bushes, saying, now don't y'all smoke or talk or do nothing. Just when he lit that cigarette, all of them get right up and went and got in that car. And everybody was quiet, not a light or anything. What they call a little shifter, a little engine, came, hitched onto that car. And the train, Broadway Limited, was going north. He stuck it onto the back of that last car. And when that pulled out, it pulled on up. And the engineer knew that all of them was in this thing. Before it got into the New York City, uncoupled that little car back there and pushed it aside, that little shifter. Come and push that car aside way over there, and the men had to stay in that car till just about daylight when a great big van came, and they got out that van and came on to where they were going to be hired. That's how my father got away.
The desire to flee north spread like wildfire. The floodgates were open, and black men and women, having cast down their buckets where they were and finding the water undrinkable, like the Jews fleeing Egypt, packed up their belongings and headed for the promised land. Edgar Campbell.
Oh, we were told, why go up there? You know what it could be. You know what it's down here. You don't know what you're running into up there. And the more they said that, the more people wanted to go. I remember as if it was yesterday. There were thousands of them at the station waiting to get on a train to go north. Thousands. Like herds in a cattle. It's
Some of them walked out of their homes and didn't take nothing.
Yes, I'm moving up the highway. Yes, I'm moving up the highway. Oh, sit up on my back and he's trying to mind me back. Well, I'm moving up the highway.
Between 1910 and 1920, Chicago's black population would soar from 44,000 to 110,000. Cleveland's from 8 to 34,000. Detroit from 6 to 41,000. And New York's from 92 to 152,000. In all, some 1.5 million blacks would leave the South between 1916 and 1929. A 500,000 in the late 1910s alone. Philadelphia, with its many industries and close proximity to the South, from the start was one of the major destination points. Between 1916 and 1918, some 40,000 people would pour into the city at a rate of 150 a week, until the spring of 1918, when between 8 and 12,000 arrived between April and June. The city's black population would leap from 84,000 in 1910 to 134,000 in 1920, and 219,000 a decade later. So why did people make the trip north? What motivated them to abandon the familiar scenes of their childhoods, pick up their belongings, and head on up to the big city? In our last program, Life in the South, you heard of those long-standing conditions back home that had enslaved and demeaned us in the South. But before the First World War broke out, Southern blacks weren't all that welcome up north. Then, during the early years of the war, the Northern demand for Southern workers was accompanied by a series of natural calamities in Dixie that made everybody want to leave. The most important of these occurrences was a little green bug, then making its way from Mexico up through Texas and into the Deep South. The boll weevil literally ate its way east, forcing thousands off the land and leaving ruin in its wake. In the summer of 1916, severe floods ravaged Alabama and Mississippi. Worldwide, cotton prices were depressed. Unable to stay on the farms, unwanted in the towns and cities, many had no choice but to move on. So there you have it. All the ingredients were present, the push and the pull.
1916, I made 16 bales of cotton. 1917, I cut in half. The next year, still cut in half. And the next year, was nothing.
Hughesy Childs, one of nine children, grew up on a cotton farm outside of Abbeville, South Carolina.
So you see now what you're going to do. Because in the South, at that particular time, the only way we only thing that we had to make money was with cotton. That's the only commodity we had. But the boll weevil come in, and that's what started bad. That's what started people coming here, because the farmer, he didn't have no other place to go, and there wasn't no jobs there for him. I looked at the farm where I used to be. Where I used to farm when I went home, and trees as tall as this house. It's no farmland. All of it's grown up. And I often said the reason why the boll weevil came, that was God's work. He did that for a purpose, because the people were cheating the people so badly, and he got tired of them cheating them, so he just said, now I'm going to farm myself, I'm going to send myself down there as something and tear it up.
In Philadelphia, representatives of the Armstrong Association surveyed newcomers. They asked about their reasons for coming north, about their past and current lives. Now, the reason given most often in this, as other surveys, was that they had come for better wages. A man or a woman could make in a day what they had made in the South in a week. But of course, there was more to it than that. Southerner J. Max Barber was president of the Philadelphia branch of the NAACP when the Great Migration began.
Let one who was born and raised in the South and who is thoroughly in touch with the situation explain the underlying cause of this immense migration. The basic cause of the Negro exodus is not economic. True, wages are higher in this section, and that is undoubtedly a contributing cause. But the real, The fundamental cause animating this movement is the awful injustice, the inhumanity of the South toward her black population. The Negroes are tired of being lynched with impunity. They are tired of the mean, dirty, Jim Crow conditions that are forced on them everywhere they turn. They are tired of disenfranchisement at the polls. They are tired about the fool talk about social equality whenever they ask for decent accommodations in places set aside for the public. They are tired of paying taxes to support institutions like public libraries, which they cannot enter. They are tired of reptilian hate, which condemns them and their children to the slime pits of civilization. And the immense jaws of this bigotry seem remorseless in their clutch, unrelenting in their stranglehold. If you talk to the people of the South, they will tell you the Negro is an awful burden, but he is a burden which they will not allow you to relieve them of. They warn him, but they do not want to treat him halfway decently. Let the South give her colored population better schools. Abolish Jim Crowism. Allow the Negro, like any other human being, to have a voice in government. And get out of her head that the Negro craves half as much of this social equality as the Southerner has shown by his own actions that he enjoys. And the Negro will cease. Until then, this exodus, like a gigantic strike against intolerable conditions, will continue.
I imagine if my father hadn't had an incident with the man he was working with for, I don't think we would have been up here. Because I think the country still stayed in a lot of us.
Annabel White.
My mother and father raised 11 children. My mother had 17 through two marriages. Mm. And they raised 11. And that time, I imagine you had children to help on the farm because you needed them, especially when you're sharecropping. And then my father, he would go work in the sawmills. And that was cash money then. So he had all his food and all his grain and his meal and flour and meat because he had his pig and things like that. And while he was working, when he worked in the sawmill, he said his boss would not pay him cash money. He told him that all his I'm going to use the word that my father said sure. The man used. He said all his niggers gets paid from his store. So my father said, he told him, say, well, I don't need your food. He said, because I have plenty of my own. He says, and I need this money, my cash money, to buy my children's shoes and clothes and things like this. And the man would not give it to him. So he came home, my mother told me to say, my father came home and he was very sad and downhearted, and then he got angry. And he told my mother, he said, this is when he woke up the next morning, he said, he's gonna give me my money today or else. And he went back to the mill where the man was, and he asked him, he said, he pleaded with him, he says, please give me my money. And he said, the man, he said, put his hands in the pocket, pulled his money out, and threw the money on the ground, and told him he would never live to spend it. Well, in those days, well, you know, let's say, you use the expression, white man rules. So when you use those kind of terms, you know what they kind of mean. My father came home, he packed some clothes what he had, and my mother packed him some lunch, and he left the family there. And after my father came to Philadelphia, he got a job, and he worked and saved his money, and then he sent for all of us, and we all came up together. Look, I imagine you've seen pictures of people trained with the paper bags and shoe boxes, and I imagine that's what it looked like. So then we came to Philadelphia, and we've been here ever since.
We had had trouble with the Caucasian majority.
Walter Gay grew up in Dawson, Georgia.
I had been beat. I had been beaten over trifles. Well, my sister was beat because she refused to walk on the side of the street reserved for blacks. My beating was the result of getting a bicycle, which was probably the eye catcher for the town. And those who were jealous of it, why, took it out on me. I heard my parents state that even at that age, I've heard my mother state this, she realized that if I stayed in the South, I would get killed. as an individual that I was so determined in certain fields, civil rights field, that sort of thing. I inherited human rights, that it was dangerous, that I would have been killed. And I think this is the background which motivated them more than the boll weevil to leave.
June 1917. Negroes still going north. A crowd left from Greenwood Saturday night. A farm boy of Greenwood County went north last October to work for $25 a week. He came home last week to assist his people on the farm and brought more than $100 and plenty of nice clothes. He gave his mother $50, put $50 in the Greenwood bank, and had some pocket change left.
As these glowing reports came back home, more and more people headed north. Old friends and family members would return home, money jingling in their pockets, wearing fancy new clothes, and telling great tales of how they were doing well in Philadelphia.
You know, you get rumors. Somebody's been up north and came back to visit. They tell you how great it is. So many privileges that they enjoyed in the north that we were denied in the South. And people coming back, telling you what a wonderful place. They talk about jobs were plentiful, homes were plentiful. It's just where you should be. And just by word of mouth, they started to migrate.
Some of the boys got to talk about the brickyard. Some of them did go in the brickyard and come back dressed up, walking around. They go up in June, and they come back in September. Too cold for them to come back.
James Plunkett.
And so when they come back home, well, they had a pretty good little heel of money. Yes, all of them went up and made money enough up there to buy them a little farms and little horses and all and go for themselves. And a lot of them went up there and stayed, never come back. So I figured I'd go up there. I went up there.
And go he did, leaving in the spring of 1917.
Everybody will be happy, will be happy. Oh, the band.
Yes, it was a wonderful thing. At long last, God had made a way for his children to escape from the bondage of the South. And the reports that came back were absolutely fascinating. Good wages, good education for the kids, no more yes sir, no mammon, or being called nigger. Sure, it might be cold, but that was a small price to pay for the rest. It just sounded so good, almost too good to be true. But really, was Philadelphia and the rest of the North the Canaan land? Think of what it must have been like to pack up your bags and boxes and leave. What questions, what hopes and expectations must have run through your mind? What would you really find? What would Philadelphia actually be like? What did the city of brotherly love hold in store?
Everybody will be happy over there.
Going North, Tales of the Great Migration was conceived, written, and produced by Charles Hardy. Narration by Reverend Marshall Lorenzo Shepherd, Jr. Engineered by Leonard Persky at Toucan Productions in Philadelphia. The interviews with Ernest Gray and William Brown were recorded by Donna DeVore. Phonograph recordings courtesy of David Goldenberg, Doug Shiroff, and Russ Shore. Readings by Nathaniel Rory. This is a public history project of the Atwater Kent Museum. Funding was made possible by grants from the Pennsylvania Humanities Council and the following contributors: the Samuel S. Fells Fund and the Sun Company.
Sing his praises, everybody
will be happy.
This program is made possible in part by a grant from the American Public Radio Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.